Welcome back to another episode of East in the Arena, a place where we talk to East members about the unique things they do, why they do them, and how. On this episode, we got to learn about the Trauma Full-Time Equivalent, or FTE, and how we can do better at defining what one FTE is. Dr. Pat Murphy has spent the last couple years looking into this topic for the betterment of our specialty. And this episode was actually quite timely, because at the time of the recording, Jeremy and I were both looking for jobs. And I hope this is just as helpful for those of you finishing up fellowship and looking for jobs as it was for me. Now, Jeremy, Pat did his fellowship at Indiana, right? I heard he had quite the reputation.
Here's why I know Pat Murphy based on the legend of Pat Murphy. Pat Murphy at Methodist Hospital took so much call and did so much clinical work. I mean, the guy was, as the story goes, a beast, that the institution put caps on how much call fellows could take because he took so much that they were paying too much money in call pay. They're like, he's one person was bankrupting them. That's Pat Murphy. The guy is a machine.
Oh, something for all residents to aspire to.
I try to do the exact opposite. My goal is to be the anti-Pat Murphy.
All right. Well, why don't we start off by getting to know Pat Murphy a little bit?
I'm Canadian. I was born on the East Coast of Canada, although I did all my medical training in Ontario. So I did 4 years of medical school at Queen's University in Kingston, and then I did a five-year dental surgery residency in London, Ontario.
Which he claims is also known as the second best London in the world.
And the unique part about that residency was the third year was somewhat of a flex year. You could do kind of what you wanted within reason without having to extend your training. I did my MPH at Hopkins in person for a few months, and then I did my Master's of Science at Western at the same time.
So quite a productive year for him.
And then I did fellowship in Indiana, largely because in Canada, the operative trauma volume is basically the opposite of the operative trauma volume in the United States, in that I did a five-year residency and I saw a single GSW that was operative. We were the catchment area for between 1 and 2 million people.
One GSW in 5 years.
That's insane.
And to be a trauma surgeon in Canada, which was my plan at the time.
Let's just say he got some sound advice.
Go to America.
Isn't that kind of sad?
That's so sad.
Go to America to learn how to treat trauma patients.
Go to the place where the disease exists.
Right.
You know how the U.S. Embassy puts out travel warnings about going to other countries?
Do other countries do that for us?
Have you ever seen the travel warnings from the UK and from Japan about coming to the United States? I read them the other day. They're random acts of violence are not uncommon in the United States. It's really scary. It makes it sound really, really bad.
It's like when you go to other places, you read the travel warnings dengue fever could be high this year. Get vaccinated. This is human beings exist and they may murder you.
First 2 weeks of fellowship, I think I saw 10 GSWs that we operated on. And, when you come back, you're the trauma guy. And so that's how I kind of ended up in Indiana. I did a two-year fellowship because I wanted to do academics and I wanted to get a high volume operative trauma because that's what I was kind of missing from, I think, largely my training.
It worked out that he had the opportunity to stay in the U.S.
And ended up in Milwaukee. I was introduced to Dr. DeMoya by one of my partners. I was fortunate enough to start working at MCW just over 2 years ago now.
So Pat and I had a great conversation about his research into trauma FTEs. The first question I asked him was, how did you get into this? And he had a very simple answer.
So that came to be when I was kind of looking for a job, actually.
Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, right? That's intuitive.
Yeah.
Jeremy, when you were looking for your job, were you asking programs, what's your definition of one FTE?
Yes, I was, but in a very rudimentary way because of COVID. So when I was applying, I wanted a level one. I wanted to be geographically close to people that we deemed important. At the times I was looking, there were three places hiring. And what the job was, very naively, did not matter to me as much as what surrounded the job, all the family stuff, the living situation. And I remember asking questions like that, but I didn't know what to ask. I'm like, how many shifts am I working? And they go oh yeah, you're only going to work like 15 shifts a month. I'm like, only 15?
Well, because that's all we know is trainees. It's working constantly.
Right? Like I worked my ass off for the last 8 years. And so working only 15 shifts a month, I'm like, hells, sign me up. That sounds amazing. And I didn't ask at all about all the things that fill that out. Like what's required of me? What happens if I have to work more? What happens if I work less? The totality of it.
It's amazing. I asked many of the programs that I interviewed at, what is your definition of one FTE? The answers were all over the board,
yeah.
But all of them were masked in vagaries. Nobody could give me a straight answer as to, well, this is one FTE. I remember one position, like, you know, you may work between 26 and 32 clinical weeks a year. Well, what is it, 26 or 32? Because that's an extra month and a half of clinical duty.
Yeah.
Do you get paid extra for that? Do you not get paid extra? Is that just rounded out? Like, well, if technically 26 is one FTE, then wouldn't that be 1 1/12 FTE? Like, nobody could tell me. And there's no cogent definition.
Yeah. So, Mike, your question about what is an FTE is spot on. Here's what Pat has to say about it.
You know, when you go to a job website, you know, for us, that's WST or East, and you actually look at the job postings. And I did this recently for a talk I was given. If you actually look at those job postings, they talk about how nice the city is,
how big the hospital is,
kind of some of their volumes related to trauma, blood penetrating,
how big the group is,
nice things to do on the weekends. If, for the most part, as far as I can tell, are missing what most people actually care about. How much am I going to work?
How long am I going
to
work?
What services am I going to work on? How much call do I have to do, and what am I going to be paid? On 90% of those job postings, those four or five things are totally absent.
Just think about that. What he just said, like, in what other field is the job description not include those things? Yeah. Whereas in our field, it's normal to not include those things.
Which I think does a disservice to our profession. And part of the reason they're absent is because no one has tried to really define what they are.
Now, what he discusses next, I found very interesting. He describes the traditional way that most trauma divisions and even other specialties define an FTE.
You take the amount of shifts, weeks, call, clinical volume, you divide by how many providers you have, and you say that is a full-time job, which it's one way to do it.
Okay, so what's a better way to do it?
You should probably aiming to staff your division department by what you think is an appropriate volume of work for a provider, taking the amount of clinical volume or services you have to cover and doing the multiplication instead of the division. So figuring out how many providers you need to safely provide high quality care to meet the demands of your services. And in academics, that might include hiring people whose job it is not just to do clinical activities.
So you kind of think about, what does my division want to accomplish?
From research,
education,
administration,
and clinically.
And then how many people do we need to accomplish that? And still allowing those people to not burn out, to have good quality of life, and achieve what they want to do career-wise.
Because the reality is that among all surgeons,
trauma surgeons have the highest rate of burnout, the lowest mental quality of life, and rank third in depression.
Yeah, that checks a lot of boxes.
I never knew those stats.
I learned those recently because I wrote a review on sleep deprivation and burnout. And I read a lot of studies on like this stuff, and it was highly depressing. I'm like, oh sweet, good.
Yeah.
Highest rate of burnout amongst surgeons.
That's ridiculous.
We went through specialized training specifically to do this job, and we are the most burnt out of all surgeons. That's crazy.
So there's clearly a discrepancy between the quality of life of the surgeon and the work they're doing. And you might make the argument that maybe trauma surgeons are just prone to all those things. And that might be true. But the surveys that have been done would suggest it's largely related to on-call work, number of hours of work, and minimal control over their job.
Bob Oxirani had a great saying for trauma. To be a trauma surgeon, you have to like fishing. You can't like fish. Right? You got to go through all the ground level falls to get the stab to the heart. Right? That's kind of the penance that you pay. You got to do all of it. But it also gets to when Pat was talking about how we come up with an FTE and we do it in a divisive way and not a multiplicative way. That plays into all this too, because if it's like a power output type thing, right? Like patients seen per hour of time on, it gets to be very taxing. But that's a very easy equation to solve for, which is why everyone does it.
Exactly. It's a complicated thing for a division chief to work out, right? They have to have a global understanding of the services the division currently provides, a more nuanced understanding of what they want to build out so they know what's coming in the future. Most importantly, they have to understand what is safe and healthy for one person to do. And then they do the math to figure out how many people they need to do all the stuff they need to do now and that they want to do in the future. It's complicated.
The argument or rebuttal for that is, well, if we do that, we're going to have to hire a lot of trauma surgeons. Yes. Yeah, like we're going to have to train more trauma surgeons. And it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy for both ways.
If your job is miserable, no one wants to do it. So there's more work for the current group of surgeons.
If you make your jobs more palatable from a work-life balance such that people want to do that and stay in it, and it looks like a good career, more people are going to want to do it. And you'll kind of solve that shortage over a period of years.
The other argument he hears often is that there's a fine balance between workload and maintenance of competence.
If you do a Saturday call at a less busy place, you might not operate. And then if you're also not working as much as traditionally have clinically, and you're doing maybe less busy calls, how are you going to be comfortable operating? I don't think that should be a barrier, full stop, can't do this. We can think of creative ways to maintain competence and expertise, specifically for kind of junior faculty. And I think there's lots of ways people do that.
For example, early career surgeons tend to do more acute care surgery, which has a higher frequency of operations.
I do elective surgery for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is because I can do 50 elective cases a year, and I know when I schedule a Friday, I'm going to do 4 cases versus a 24-hour call at a low-volume trauma center, you might do like 2 gallbladders. So the Friday, you know, during the daytime, you became a lot more efficient in getting those operative repetitions in. So I think there's creative ways to really counteract the argument that, well, if you stop working so much, you're not going to do enough cases to be comfortable and competent. That and the we need to hire more surgeons, I think, are the two most common rebuttals that I get.
He has put an immense amount of thought into this. Like, you can tell by the way he's talking about it, like, this is something that A, he is very passionate about, and B, that he thinks about actively, because it's just hitting all the points right on the head.
And the best part is that he's put his money where his mouth is, so to speak, and actually researched this topic.
Mm-hmm.
He and his colleagues conducted a mixed methods qualitative study where they sent out a survey to trauma program directors and then interviewed a subset of those to get some more details. Before interviewing Pat, I actually read this article and I was really impressed.
Yeah.
The granularity of the data they collected was remarkable.
The nice thing about qualitative studies is you get an enormous amount of rich, storied information that is, you know, just doing the interviews was incredibly enlightening. The bad part about qualitative studies is you get a robust, immense amount of information to try to sift through and, you know, craft into this cogent argument that makes sense.
It was really interesting to see the direct quotes they included from their interviews.
Just like a picture, I think when you read some of these quotes, it really drives home what we're actually talking about. One of my favorite quotes in there is that we're kind of like firefighters, our specialty. And I think that's true of, you know, emergency medicine, hospitalists, medical ICU, in that largely our jobs are to be available for emergencies.
Whether those are traumas coming in through the emergency department, someone losing an airway on the floor that you've never met, or bleeding patients who may or may not be on your service.
That's what our job largely is. That is, you know, not really how they're viewed everywhere, because a lot of our specialty is RVU-based, which is counterintuitive because I don't cause appendicitis. I don't shoot people. In fact, I've never shot a gun. I don't stab people. I don't cause car collisions.
So why then would we be judged based on RVUs?
Like, that makes no sense. But that's in many institutions across the country is how we're paid and judged. That's not really a reflection of reality. Those quotes really, I think, highlight some of those challenges that we're trying to sort out within the specialty about how much we should work, how we should be compensated for that work, and how should we sustain our specialty? Because at the rate we're going, as more and more hospitals go to the acute care surgery model, we're already short a lot of surgeons.
And that gets into the vicious cycle of burnout and people leaving the specialty.
To really get a sustainable specialty, we have to define what a reasonable trauma acute care surgeon should work, how they can maintain their competence and be creative maybe in that, and then how we should be compensated for that.
Pat, so far what we've heard is incredible. Tell us about the impact that your research has had on how things are done at Medical College of Wisconsin.
When I met Dr. DeMoya, he was one of kind of two people when I was talking to people about jobs who could actually tell me what the job was. He said, it's going to be 26 weeks of service and 4 to 5 calls a month, no more than 2 weekends. He, you know, as you might imagine, given his interest in this, kind of had his own definition of what he kind of thought was reasonable. And he did go out of his way when I first started to kind of creatively make sure I was operating.
He was scheduled for more acute care surgery weeks. He was encouraged to do elective surgery, and most of his call was trauma or acute care call instead of ICU call.
That was very intentional, I think, on my division's part. And from the outside, if you look at our division compared to other divisions at similar size centers, we look quite robust from a staffing standpoint.
At the time of this recording, the MCW ACS Trauma Division had 16 surgeons.
Now, not all of them are 1.0 clinical. So I think in the end, we probably have 12 or 13 FTEs, but we also have 2 people in-house 365. So to meet that call amount, you have to have this many people if you only want them to do 4 call a month. So he kind of worked it out from here's how much call we have with 2 people in-house. I think 4 call a month is reasonable, which I think most people would probably agree with. Here's how many surgeons we would need, or how many full-time equivalents. And if you're going to do partial, you need to get more surgeons, obviously.
Then the question is, well, we have 16 surgeons to comfortably cover the call shifts. How are we going to keep them clinically productive and busy during the day to justify their existence for call?
You know, that was kind of one of the other quotes. You have to build the daytime work to support the nighttime work. Lots of places have gotten creative with this. We now have 2 trauma teams because our trauma census was getting to be 50 or 60. Our ICU volumes were getting super high. So now we have 2 people on ICU. We have an acute care surgery staff, and then we have a flex staff who just kind of helps out as needed. So every day, we have 6 staff who have a daytime task.
What's weird is in other professions, like in critical care, there have been papers that describe how big should your service be, how many patients should any intensivist see in a given day before you start having diminishing returns on care. And that's like what, like 14 to 16, somewhere in that ballpark? But that doesn't exist for trauma surgeons.
Right. We should easily be able to define the limits for the trauma surgeon and split services when they get too big. And ideally, when you split the service, you hire somebody new to then staff that service as opposed to using your existing cohort of providers.
And we get very staff-centric because we're staff. We're all faculty, right? Or soon to be faculty. Sure, you can split a service. Do you have the APPs? Do you have the residents? Well, I'm also useless without a team if it's like a 20-patient service.
Yeah.
And so flexing up is really hard.
Other places have started, you know, nutrition services. So they've kind of taken over the TPN in the hospital. They kind of run that. That gives people daytime work and provides a service for the hospital. Brakes and pegs, airway teams.
Elective surgery.
Lots of places have tried and I think successfully moved out to the community in some respects to try to approach acute care surgery from a systems basis. So it's not just trauma system,
but an emergency general surgery service for their entire hospital system.
More daytime work. It doesn't really add any nighttime call. And so that's a nice way to sustain kind of meeting the clinical demands of the main campus, but providing daytime activity, career activity, financial productivity for the surgeons that you need to do that amount of call without having to do 7 call each in-house. I tell people we have 16 surgeons, they're like, we have 8. And I'm like, then you're working too much. Or they get no vacation, or both.
Agreed. Hard agree.
So what's coming next? What do you think is in the future of the acute care surgery FTE?
You know, having talked to all these division heads as a junior faculty, I kind of wondered when that study was done, if junior faculty, you know, 0 to 5 years would feel the same with respect to what they view as, you know, the ideal state of a job.
So they did basically the same study, but for early career surgeons.
We surveyed about 400 surgeons, kind of similar mixed methods, and talked to about 30 of them to get their perspective on what a full-time job was, which was the same but different, which was kind of curious at the time.
What else needs to be sorted out in this field?
So there's lots of things to consider that we haven't even scratched the surface of. Like, we know nighttime work leads to worse health outcomes. That's well demonstrated in the nursing population. We know shift work leads to worse health outcomes. That's demonstrated in lots of professions, including nursing.
I'm waiting for the day that there's going to be a class action lawsuit against multiple healthcare industries because some surgeon got cancer and attributes it to the very high increased risk of cancer in people that are sleep deprived. It's already been shown to be a risk factor for cancer.
Dr. Jamie Coleman did a study that is yet unpublished using physiologic data and call. And I think anecdotally, most of us, it's not the post-call day that sucks. It's the post-post-call day where I'm like totally discombobulated, particularly if you're up all night and got no sleep. Post-post-call day, you're just like gassed. And so we're just kind of scratching the surface of health and how it relates to our work.
Pat sometimes worries that people might think that prescription is bad.
That has never been the goal. The goal has always been, both by myself and others, to maintain a sustainable, healthy specialty in the face of the reality that our specialty is one of the least healthiest of the surgical subspecialties from a number of metrics. And I think it's challenging to ask people, particularly in this day and age, to go into that specialty when you're saying, well, half of you are going to burn out. A lot of you are going to get divorced. You know, you might not be part of your kid. Like, that era has largely passed in that people just won't go into that specialty then. And then you are already a specialty in stress, and now you're even worse off. And that's where I think a lot of this like acute care surgery model has come from. It's come from taking care of patients and providing continuity, but it's also come from recognizing that this model improves surgeon quality of life, like drastically. By having this kind of shared practice model, surgeons' lives have improved. And we shouldn't stop with modest improvement. We should go full speed and say, how can we take really good care of patients, but also have a sustainable, healthy specialty of surgeons?
Pat, we can't thank you enough for joining us on East in the Arena and for pouring your efforts into creating a more sustainable specialty. As I mentioned before, this discussion was really enlightening for me as I went through the job search process, and it really helped me ask the right questions during interviews. I hope it was just as helpful for all of you going through the same process. East in the Arena is a product of the Educational Resources Committee and created by Jeremy Levin, Sham Murley, and Mike Radomski. If you want to check out more In the Arena episodes or other East products, including the TraumaCast and CareerCast, visit east.org or wherever fine podcasts are found. This episode was produced by me, Sean Murley. Intro and outro music were produced by Matt Holzmacher. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Hey, Annabelle, can you close my door, please, sweetheart?
Yes.
Thank you.
What goes up but never comes down?
What?
Your age.
Oh, great.
Jeremy, please tell me you got that on recording.
That's on there. That is on there. That was really good. That's like A-level dad joke right there.
Yeah, that's my daughter. That's great.
Yeah, that's going in. That's amazing. That's a B-reel at the end for sure.